Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with the News Gazette. Since the News Gazette doesn't publish on Mondays anymore, we are going to be reading stories from Saturday, February 8th, 2020, and Sunday, February 9th, 2020. And we are going to start off with a front page story from Saturday's paper titled, City of Urbana's Bill, $2,531,912, and this relates to the Carl tax case. It's datelined Urbana. Of the seven taxing districts that will share in a court-ordered property tax refund to the Carl Health System, the City of Urbana will have the largest payment to make. In finding Carl qualified for property tax exemptions on four of its Urbana properties from 2005 to 2011, Judge Randy Rosenbaum earlier this week ordered a total property tax refund of $6,240,491 to be made to Carl by the county treasurer. Urbana's share of that will be $2,531,912, according to Champaign County Chief Deputy Treasurer C. Pius Weibel. The refund amounts each taxing district will owe have just been calculated, he said, and the amounts that the other six taxing districts will owe include, for Champaign County, $1,481,897. For Parkland College, $967,414. For the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District, $517,467. For the Cunningham Township, $367,295. And for the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District, $205,589, and the Champaign County Forest Preserve, $156,913. While the refund must be made by the treasurer's office, Weibel said, the money to cover the check will be coming from the seven taxing districts. He said he hopes to issue a check to Carl within 2 months. The treasurer's office will be working with each of these taxing bodies to facilitate the transfer of funds to the county in order to issue the refund in a timely manner, Weibel said Friday. No decision has been made whether to appeal the ruling, but that decision is not likely to affect the payment of the refund. The Urbana School and Park districts are not subject to a refund because both settled their way out of Carl's lawsuit against local taxing authorities in 2013. And under the settlement agreement, the school and park districts were required to refund part of Carl's tax payments through 2018. And the other front page story from Saturday's paper is written by Jim Dye, and it is titled, Experience Gives Veteran Edge as Author. Just like any author, David Grogan doesn't like to give away the details, particularly intimate ones, involving the characters and plot lines of his novels. So if you ask him if Steve Stillwell, Grogan's continuing hero, will get back together with his estranged wife, he feigns ignorance. I don't know, he replies. Left unstated is that readers will have to pick up a copy of The Hidden Key and find out for themselves. I just want readers to read it, like it, and come back for more, said Grogan, a retired Navy captain and lawyer who works a day job at the University of Illinois. On nights and weekends, he pursues another vocation as an author who builds mysterious international adventures around the fictional Stillwell, whom Grogan describes as the lawyer I wanted to be. A former military lawyer who stumbled into fiction writing, Grogan has just completed his third Stillwell novel. The Hidden Key, published by Seattle-based Camel Press, is scheduled to be released in mid-April. It's available for pre-ordering from Amazon and Barnes & Noble. "I'm not John Grisham," he said, "but I enjoy writing." Parents of three adult children, Grogan and his wife, Sharon, live in Savoy. They moved here from Virginia in 2014 after he wrapped up a 27-year military career and took a job as the UI's Associate Director of Compliance. Grogan brings a well-rounded background to his novels. During his military career, he lived in Cuba, Japan, and Bahrain, served on the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier USS Enterprise, helped negotiate military agreement with foreign nations, and both prosecuted and defended court-martial cases. And one place Grogan never made it to is Vietnam. That's why he felt compelled to visit that country to do research for his second Stillwell novel, Sapphire Pavilion. Unlike many authors, Grogan was not born to write. It wasn't until he was getting a master's degree in law at George Washington University and took a class in human rights that he was bitten by the writing bug. "That's what gave him the idea for the Siegel Dispositions," he said. The Siegel Dispositions is a murder mystery that develops after Stillwell, a retired military officer who runs a small-town law practice, is hired to update the will of a 70-year-old Auschwitz survivor, Professor Felix Siegel. Accompanying the professor is his beautiful but surly adopted daughter, Michelle. Michelle will inherit, but there is a catch. The first $1.5 million of Siegel's fortune goes to three wartime friends if they survive him, a plot description states. Book 2, Sapphire Pavilion, focuses on events emanating from the search for an Air Force transport plane that disappeared in 1968 and whose ramifications continue to be felt decades later. The Hidden Key builds on events in Iraq, where CB's constructing a military base in 2004 unearth a mysterious tablet that features a map that Grogan says leads to something of value. And that is part of the quest, he said. Grogan's quest is a bit different than Stillwell's search for a hidden fortune or a place of splendor. He's searching for readers, and that involves doing much of the marketing, actually selling himself. He appears at bookstores and actually tours the country to meet potential readers and persuade them to give Grogan and Stillwell a chance. "Where I actually have a lot of success is on military installations. Because I'm a veteran, they'll talk to me," he said. Grogan said he enjoys the feeling of being a published author, but that he has not built his reputation up quite as much as he would like. He said his neighbors will sometimes ask what's forthcoming, but when I'm walking down the street, my anonymity is still assured. And that is quite unlike Steve Stillwell. He became the subject of worldwide publicity after his Vietnam-related caper. It seems a billionaire businessman read about him and decided to hire him to do some legal work, a process that was interrupted by the businessman's sudden and untimely death. Mystery abounds, of course. Like what? Grogan isn't saying. And Saturday's paper also has this story, shooting suspect accused of robbery. It's datelined Urbana. A former Danville man charged with killing a man in Champaign almost 2 years ago was in the process of robbing him, prosecutors say. That allegation against Michael Chapman, age 20, came out Friday as he was formally arraigned on 4 counts of first-degree murder for the March 23, 2018 shooting death of Ricky Green. Chapman, who listed an address in Montgomery, was returned to Urbana on Thursday afternoon following his arrest last Monday in Plano by Champaign Police detectives and the U.S. Marshals. Champaign Police sought a warrant for Chapman's arrest a little over 2 weeks ago. Judge Randy Rosenbaum read Chapman the charges that allege he personally discharged the gun that killed Mr. Green, that he intended to kill him, that he knew the shooting would cause death or great bodily harm, and that he shot him in the commission of a robbery. The 18-year-old Urbana man was found mortally wounded in the 100 block of Apricot Drive in the Shadowwood Mobile Home Park, east of North Market Street in North Champaign. Police were called to a report of shots fired, found him on the street, and administered first aid until he got to Carl Foundation Hospital, where he died about 9 hours later. Rosenbaum explained to Chapman that if he's convicted of the counts alleging that he personally discharged the gun or that he robbed Mr. Green during the shooting, he faces 45 years to life upon conviction instead of the normal range of 20 to 60 years for murder. Rosenbaum appointed the public defender's office to represent Chapman, who had prior convictions for obstructing justice and possession of a handgun. Rosenbaum left his bond at the $1 million set by Judge Robert Weber. When Weber issued the warrant, Chapman was told to return to court March 10th. Now here's some stories from the front page of Sunday's paper. The first one is, harassment findings put UI cop's job in jeopardy. Not over yet, officer vows, despite scathing report on treatment of female co-workers. It's written by Mary Schenck, and it is datelined Urbana. A veteran University of Illinois police officer accused of sexual harassment by co-workers has been off the state payroll for 7 weeks following his suspension notice pending discharge. The December 20th notice was served to Brian Tyson via certified mail less than 2 months after an outside lawyer hired by the U of I recommended that significant employment action be taken against the former field training, crisis intervention, and SWAT officer, who had earlier been put on notice that his physical interactions with coworkers were not acceptable. Contacted Friday by the News Gazette, Tyson, age 51, said he could not comment. I can't say anything about anything. I'm not allowed by the department, and it's not anywhere near to being done, said Tyson, who has 27 years of experience as a police officer, 4 with the Vermilion County Sheriff's Department, and 23 years with the U of I. U of I police spokesman Pat Wade's response seemed to agree with Tyson's that the matter has not yet been settled. We are obligated by university policy and the collective bargaining agreement to follow a prescribed process related to discharge, and that is what we are following, Wade said. That is all I am able to provide for now, as this is an ongoing personnel issue. Tyson's attorney, William Jarvis of the Fraternal Order of Police Counsel in Springfield, said he could not answer questions because the matter is still being resolved. Using the Freedom of Information Act, the News Gazette obtained a summary of an investigation done by Chicago lawyer Peter Land of the firm Hoosh Blackwell into allegations made against Tyson by 3 female U of I police officers. The investigation was the 3rd into Tyson's conduct in 2 years. Others were done by the University Office for Access and Equity beginning in 2017. The U of I initiated the Hoosh Blackwell investigation after the 3 women decided not to pursue individual complaints, Land explained in his summary. The Hoosh Blackwell website bills Land, a partner, as an advocate for higher education institutions and academic medical centers who litigates claims of employment discrimination, harassment, faculty termination, Title IX sexual assault claims, and other matters. The documents provided to the News Gazette were heavily redacted so as not to identify the women or reveal specifics of their interviews with Land. Also redacted were Tyson's responses to the allegations provided in writing through his attorney. Tyson declined to be interviewed by Land, who said he reviewed transcripts of 2 interviews that Tyson did with a U of I police lieutenant in December 2018 and February 2019. Of 33 pages provided through the FOIA request, parts or all of 31 pages were blacked out. Tyson was given a copy of Land's report in early October. And here is a quote from that report. In the instant investigation, three women, names redacted, have alleged that Tyson engaged in a series of unwelcome, offensive actions with them and others over a period of as long as 17 years, including making inappropriate sexually charged comments to female recruits, inappropriately touching, hugging, massaging, and kissing female recruits and female officers, bringing a junior female coworker to a secluded building late at night, and retaliating against witnesses who participated in the first investigations. Unquote. Tyson was hired by the U of I police in April 1996. His wife is also a U of I police officer. Land concluded that it was more likely than not that Tyson hugged and rubbed female officers' shoulders before, during, and after the 2018 investigation, that he made flirtatious comments about how female officers' bodies look good out of uniform or in dresses, and that he found certain women's hairstyles attractive, that he made comments on the bodies and appearances of the wives of male officers in settings in which the men and their wives found the comments unwelcome, and that after the 2018 investigations, he publicly mocked the female officers' complaints about sexual misconduct, saying he had been exonerated. Land found that Tyson's conduct created a hostile environment for only one of the three women, and therefore he was guilty of violating the U of I's sexual misconduct policy only as to her. I find that Tyson's conduct toward, name redacted, perpetuated a level of anxiety for redacted, that she would be faced with unwelcome ongoing attempts by Tyson to touch her and interact with her in sexually charged or gender-based ways that started while she was a trainee in redacted and continued until 2017, he wrote. However, Land found that Tyson had violated the U of I's code of conduct as to all three women based on behavior and verbal interactions with many female officers between about 2011 and 2019. Quote, he wrote, there is no professional standard that would excuse the following. 1. Seeking to groom a romantic relationship with redacted as a trainee, with multiple examples of comments and physical touching and efforts to be alone with redacted in circumstances that involved attempts at romantic overtures, followed by multiple years of unwanted shoulder rubs when outside the presence of others but at work. 2. Ogling and seeking to hug redacted and rub her shoulders after commenting about her body size as a trainee. And 3. Creation of a work environment in which multiple female officers had legitimate concern of ongoing sexual or gender-based behavior of a similar nature, he wrote. Given the nature of Tyson's conduct and the fact policy violations continued after the 2018 investigation concluded with findings that Tyson's behavior toward women was problematic, I recommend that significant employment action be taken. And this other front page Sunday story is titled Not Just for Show, it's about CU at Home. To those who might dismiss CU at Home's main fundraiser as performative, a couple of participants who have benefited from the nonprofit services in the past say, look deeper. I think it is really important that we have this simulation. And there are photographs that accompany this story of people sleeping in temporary boxes during CU at Home's one winter night event in downtown Champaign. Snow filled the sky as Adam Ruggieri and Owen Anderson pulled a Mandalorian helmet from the popular Star Wars series out of the box where they would be sleeping Friday night on Neal Street. One winter night can look performative at first glance, they know, like an empty gesture, feigning empathy. Take a closer look, they insist, and it's not what it seems. It may be performative for some people, but for the majority of people who come out, either they've experienced any of the myriad things that contribute to homelessness, or they know somebody who has been through it, Anderson said of the event, which raises most of the budget for See You at Home, a nonprofit that provides services and shelter for the homeless. It is not easy to just reach into somebody's life and control all the right dials and pull all the right levers and fix everything for them, he said. But making sure that these resources are available for them, if we keep doing that, everything is going to be okay. The event funds the services See You at Home provides to help the homeless stay safe and get back on their feet. After operating as a daytime shelter and a transportation and transitional housing ministry for most of its decade of existence, it recently began running a winter shelter and hopes to begin operating a year-round shelter later this year. If there wasn't a shelter here right now, where would people go? See You at Home Housing and Outreach Coordinator Stephen Harper asked. More than likely, they would be shipped out to other cities on buses. People buy bus tickets, they have some outreach people in churches that buy bus tickets, and then they would end up in a shelter in another community. The shelter in this community is for the people in the community, and we can offer them a solution as far as trying to wrap around them and love them and get to the core problems of what's going on with them, whether it be mental illness or substance abuse. This year's One Winter Night was different from years past. See You at Home Executive Director Rob Dollhouse III pushed to sign up entertainers to perform between speakers at the event, which was based at the Orpheum Children's Science Museum for the second straight year. A projector on the stage was lit up with a thermometer that showed how close the event was to its goal of $350,000, which Dollhouse said is needed to open the year-round shelter. Vineyard Church pastor Clay Harrington energetically updated those at the Orpheum throughout the night and went out on the streets to broadcast on Facebook Live, giving the event the feel of a telethon. 2 years ago, One Winter Night raised $140,000 by the next morning. This year, Dollhouse expected to double that, but donations exceeded even those expectations. By mid-afternoon Saturday, the event surpassed $310,000 in donations with 2 weeks to go before fundraising wraps up. That is a God-sized jump, Dollhouse said. That's this community hearing what we have to say, hearing this mission, and our friends on the street deserve more. I'm just amazed. It's not only the coolest thing I've ever been a part of, but it is the most fulfilling thing I have ever been a part of. As Dollhouse walked the streets, one box dweller jokingly complained that he didn't place him by the city building, where sidewalks are heated by vents. Dollhouse said he was well aware of the comfort of that spot. There's one of those guys that actually sleeps over there, Dollhouse said. He doesn't like coming into the shelter, so he sleeps by the vent. While the event can't completely replicate life on the street, it does make participants make calculations that they wouldn't normally have to. If I'm out here for 20 minutes, my clothes are wet, I'm uncomfortable, said Harper, who was homeless before participating in See You at Home's transitional housing program. It's going to be freezing tonight. It's below 32. So now your clothes are wet and they're going to be freezing to you. And if we didn't have this event, we wouldn't be able to fund the shelter. We wouldn't have transitional living. We wouldn't have things like that. So I think it's really important that we have this simulation. Anderson and Ruggieri each slept on the street for a short period of time in their younger days before See You at Home existed, and they both say it was the help of strangers that got them back in a home. They don't want One Winter Night to turn into something it isn't meant to be, a jovial event where costumes are common. The Mandalorian helmet, they know, can be construed as lighthearted. But that is not the point at all, they insisted. Look deeper, they said, and the significance is clear. We weren't trying to turn the thing into a giant Star Wars fest. We just felt like there really was a connection there because That character is homeless, Ruggieri said. If you ever watch that show, a lot of it is about how they don't have a place to be and don't have a planet anymore and that they're homeless. It is not a festival. It's meant to raise awareness, and that, I hope, never gets lost. And the last front page story from Sunday's paper is written by Tom Kasich, and it is headlined, Buttigieg Bandwagon Filling Up. There's a new top Democratic presidential candidate in the Champaign-Urbana-Danville area based on campaign contributions reported to the Federal Election Commission through December 31, 2019. Former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg has taken the lead from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who had been number one and who won the 2016 Democratic primary election in Champaign County with 66% of the vote. Buttigieg has raised $20,885 in the area, which includes the Champaign, Urbana, Savoy, Danville, Mahomet, St. Joe, and Rantoul zip codes, to $20,834 for Sanders. But that is not the most fascinating thing about the Buttigieg surge. How about this? His biggest supporters locally are a one-time alternate delegate candidate to the Republican National Convention committed to Ronald Reagan, who ran 2 years ago as a GOP candidate for the Champaign County Board, and her retired Marine husband. Dan and Ginny Holder have donated $10,164, almost half of what he has raised locally, to the Buttigieg campaign, $5,600 from Dan and $4,564 from Ginny. Ginny Holder said she met Buttigieg at a function last July in Michigan and was immediately impressed. I came back from it and I told Dan, this guy is amazing. He listens to me. He gave me a hug, she recounted. He was for real. I have been to two Republican nominating conventions. Nothing has impacted me more, and maybe it's my life journey, than Pete Buttigieg and his husband, Chasten. Nothing, she said. I drove to Iowa last weekend and canvassed for him. She said she was blown away by the Buttigieg campaign operation in Davenport, Iowa. It is truly the most well-organized, positive-speaking campaign, Ginny Holder said. We walked to 85 houses, and the campaign staff tells you that Pete wants this to be positive. Don't argue. Don't say, go caucus for Pete. They want you to encourage people to caucus, and then at the end, they want you to ask, is Pete one of the top three that you might look at? That is how gentle they are. It's a persuasion that I have never seen before. Holder, who said she now considers herself a former Republican, added, you'd be surprised the people who are Pete people. A lot of them are Republicans who can't handle Trump. You can't believe the positive stuff. I got a little garbage yesterday when I pulled into the Champaign Country Club, but for the most part, people are really interested in him. They say, can you give me information about him? My journey has been very genuine and very organic, to be truthful. She's attached a Buttigieg yard sign to her car and said she would be making phone calls to New Hampshire voters from her home this weekend. It's going to be an uphill battle, but I've got faith, she said. Anybody who runs against Trump is going to have a hard battle. Locally, the other Democratic contenders are far behind Buttigieg and Sanders. Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts has raised $12,618. Former Vice President Joe Biden has brought in $3,710. Businessman Andrew Yang reported $1,755. And Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota had just $1,280. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with Part 1 of the News Gazette, February 8th and 9th, 2020.